Hello, junkies. Here we are with episode number 3 of the Nocturnal Throwback, the 2007 podcast novel that helped launch me towards the literary stratosphere. As we have done before and will continue to do, we include the original Talkie Talk from the original post. Apparently, episode 3 way back when was launched near Veterans Day, and we hear a voice from the golden days of podcast novels, one Seth Harwood. There's some other fun stuff in the Time Capsule Talkie Talk. I hope you dig it. As for what is happening now in my world, I am 95% done with the final draft of Mount Fitzroy. That last 5%, though, it's a doozy. Currently 257,000 words in that book. That is over 1,000 8.5 by 11 pages. It's a beast. Alrighty, let's get our flashback on. Here we go with Nocturnal Throwback episode number 3. Welcome to the podcast novel Nocturnal. This is episode number 3. Nocturnal is a podcast-only novel. You can't buy in stores and you can't peek at the end. Written and performed by best-selling author Scott Sigler. This book contains adult language, mature situations, and lots of violence. Hello, all my junkies, and welcome to episode 3. Only going to talk for a second, and I'll get to some more information after the episode. But first, I want to make sure that I take this Veterans Day to thank all the veterans of America's armed forces. All of you who are with us, and all of you who are no longer with us. To all the men and women and their families who sacrificed so much in order to serve for America. And especially this year for those of you who are serving overseas. As a civilian, I am eternally grateful for all that you do for us, and I hope you all come home safe. I only have one promo this week, and it's fitting Veterans Day. It's for a program called Email the Troops. That'll be at the end of the episode. Check that out. Now let's get into the story so far, courtesy of author Seth Harwood.
What's up, you dirty junkies? This is your boy, Seth Harwood, the original Palms Daddy, the writer and podcaster of Jack Palms Crime, the books Jack Wakes Up and This Is Life. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you better head on over to SethHarwood.com and check out Jack Wakes Up. Even Brian and Pookie know Jack Wakes Up. You don't believe me? Go back and listen to Nocturnal Episode 1. I'm happy to be bringing you this week's story so far. In the last episode of Nocturnal, street bum Aggie James woke up in a white-painted dungeon, along with crime lord Johnny Yee, his wife, and his 7-year-old son. Chained at the neck, the adults were held back, while strange small men dressed in hooded robes came into the dungeon and dragged the boy away. Some sick shit, Sigler. Rex, Depravdichuk, went from one bully to the next. Put in the hospital by Alex Panos when he broke his arm with 2 wooden chunks underneath his wrist and his elbow? Ow! He was taken out of the hospital by his foster mother, Roberta. At the end of the episode, Detective Brian Closser's dreams grew from bad to worse, where he's had recurring dreams of stalking the same 4 teenage boys. This time, the dream ended as he cornered one and butchered him with his fucking teeth. And then woke up with a boner? Sigler, what the fuck? I'm Seth Harwood, dying for this week's episode of Nocturnal.
The cell phone chittered its ringtone, the jazzy horns of the Hawaii Five-O theme song. Brian managed to ignore it at first, letting it ring to voicemail. But after the 3rd straight call, he opened his eyes and found himself on the couch. The TV was still on. Sci-fi channel. Playing something bad, probably. Looked like one of the giant snake movies. A nasty kink ground away in his neck, courtesy of falling asleep on the armrest. Brian looked at the wall clock. 7:13 a.m. Who in the hell would call him at this hour? He normally slept through the day, depending on what time he got home, which in itself depended on the caseload. Last night, the dream of killing the kid had woken him up, and he didn't know what time he'd fallen asleep on the couch. Even beyond the lack of sleep, he felt exhausted, like he'd put in extra hours or gone out on the town after his shift ended. He picked up the phone and checked the calls. Pookie. 3 times in a row. That fucker. Getting back at him for last night. Brian dialed.
It's about fucking time you called,
Pookie said after only half a ring. Look, man, I'm sorry about waking you up last night, but if you're going to pay me back, you can do better than this.
I'm not getting you back. Are you home?
Of course I'm home. Where else would I be?
Get your ass downstairs. I'm coming to get you.
Dude, come on. I've had like an hour or two of sleep, max. Can't I wait until 5?
No. You get your ass downstairs. I'm on my way.
Pookie hung up. They'd been partners for 6 years, long enough for Brian to know that something was up. He dressed quickly. Black socks, black pants, and a black shirt. His black Bianchi tuxedo holster came next, followed by a nylon forearm knife sheath. He scooped up his weapons from the coffee table. SOG Twitch XL knife for the forearm sheath. 40 caliber Smith & Wesson Model 4006 for the holster. The holster webbing also carried pockets for 2 additional 11-round magazines and a small handcuff holster. Brian dutifully filled these as well. Where a lot of cops carried a backup piece in an ankle holster, Brian wanted the full effect of an onion field gun, or a gun that might be missed by perp should he be taken hostage. His onion gun was a tiny Seacamp LWS-32, a .32 caliber pistol so small it fit in an imitation wallet and slid into his back left pants pocket. Satisfied his gear was in place, he laced up his flat black suede Nikes. By the time he finished, he could hear Pookie leaning on the horn outside. The guy must have been only a block or two away when he called. Brian had wanted to down some coffee before his partner arrived, but he'd have to grab that on the way to wherever they were going. He shot downstairs to find Pookie double parked, portable already spinning its red glow against the early morning light. Brian opened the door, but had to move a pair of beat-up, overstuffed manila folders before he could sit. Pookie liked to think he was earth smart by using the same folders over and over for his cases, to the point where the tan paper was nearly disintegrating at the edges. Brian quickly got in and shut the door before saying a word. He also buckled up, not because it was the law, but because Pookie looked stressed, and when Pookie was stressed, he drove like a one-eyed retard on Red Bull. Good thing you're a cop, Pooks, because your driving sucks. If you're not insulting me, we got a situation that you just might want to check out. I'm all ears. Pookie looked right at Brian. Pookie looked worried. Real worried. It was an emotion that Pookie's half-Korean, half-Chinese face did not wear well. When Pookie got stressed in a big way, his face pinched up and his eyes widened. A near panic expression, like he had to take a mega dump and he was 50 miles from the nearest restroom. Some kid was murdered last night. Big kid. And you only get one guess where he bought it. Brian felt a chill blossoming deep in his chest. I don't want to hear this, do I? A statement, not a question. No, you don't. But I'm going to tell you anyway. Leavenworth and O'Farrell. Exactly where Brian had dreamt of killing a kid. A big kid. Pookie turned his attention back to the road, then gunned the engine, once again cutting off 4 lanes of traffic as the Buick lurched into action. Cops on the scene had cordoned off the alley only, allowing traffic to continue on Leavenworth. 2 SFPD cruisers were parked at the curb. 2 more were parked on the sidewalk, one on either side of the alley, to discourage foot traffic. Bubble lights flashed blue and red. Someone had hung a yellow tarp across the mouth of the alley. Nothing to see here, just move along, please. The morgue van sat silently, like a scavenger, waiting for the detectives and the crime scene photographers to finish their work before it could claim the corpse as its own. Brian and Pookie hung their badges from their necks and walked past the tarp. A half dozen uniforms milled about, leaving plenty of room for the crime scene investigation team. The familiar pair of Sasha, Sammy Berzin, criminalist, and Jimmy Chang, crime scene photographer. One look at the body, and Brian felt cold. Rusty pipe at the bottom of the bay cold. He felt as if he might pass out at any moment. It was the man boy, spiked to a brick wall. At least most of him was. His right arm, the arm Brian had bit down on in last night's dream, was gone. A ragged, horrid, gaping negative space wound that ran from the neck down to just under where the armpit would have been had the arm still been attached. Part of his collarbone stuck out from the wound, red smeared, white, bright in the morning sun. The killer, or killers, had nailed him to the brick wall with railroad spikes. One through his remaining hand, two through his stomach, and one through his throat. The man boy's feet lie slack against the wall, free of spikes, but at least 3 feet above the filthy alley ground. 2-foot-high letters spelled out a message in psychotic graffiti, graffiti made from the victim's own blood. Long live the king. Brian remembered the words that had ripped through his mind during the dream hunt.
He had fucked with the king. One womb, motherfucker.
Brian also remembered the sweet taste of the boy's hot blood.
That's him, Brian said quietly.
That's who? Pookie asked.
That's the kid. The kid from my dreams.
A pause.
Pookie leaned in close. You're telling me that the guy nailed to the wall is the same guy from your dreams?
Yeah.
Pookie's hand on his elbow.
Just keep your shit together. And don't say another fucking word about it. Don't make a scene here. We'll figure this out later. Just keep your shit together.
If Brian did keep it together, keep his shit together, it would be a miracle.
I can't believe this.
Shut up. I don't know what's going on with you, but shut up and do your job. Take a look around. See what you can see. And if you do have some kind of fucked up psychic connection to this, you need to examine the scene. But remember one thing.
Brian's sight went in and out of focus as he stared at the boy's body.
Look at me, Brian.
Brian turned to face Pookie. The man's slightly slanted eyes burned with intensity, possibly even anger. Pookie spoke in a whisper.
You told me about this very murder scene last night. Guess what? That makes you a suspect.
What?
You look a little spaced out right now, but don't be a dumbass. You could have called me from anywhere last night, including right here. We'll figure this out, but for now, shut up, do your job, don't say another word about this shit, and don't touch anything.
Sammy was walking across the alley, head down, taking very slow steps. When he reached the far side, he would turn 90 degrees to the right, still looking down, take one step, turn another 90 degrees, then start slowly recrossing the alley. He was walking a linear pattern, examining every square inch of the brutal crime scene, looking for any evidence. He would stop every 3 or 4 steps, bend, pick something up with the tweezers, drop it into a brown paper envelope, and seal it up. Jimmy hovered around the body, shooting the grisly corpse from multiple angles. In close, far back, tight shot on a spike, practically sticking the camera into the missing shoulder, on and on. Pookie walked further into the alley, careful to stay clear of Sammy's methodical walk. Brian felt the cold hand of truth close in on his soul. Pookie was dead on. Brian had dreamt the death of this boy in this alley last night. And here was the body, nailed up like a big game trophy. All of this begged a simple question. Could he have done this? Could he have murdered this boy last night? Brian shook his head.
Of course he hadn't done this. He couldn't have done this. There had to be a rational explanation for it.
The best way to find that explanation was to do his job. He moved towards the body. It smelled like piss, but different piss. Different than the gangster scenes.
There wasn't much blood dripping down the wall from the missing arm or from the spiked areas. The boy had probably died before the murderer spiked him to the wall. So where had the killers brought him down? It sickened him, but he knew the answer. In his dream, when he brought the boy down, they'd crashed into a green and rust dumpster. He turned to the other side of the alley to look right at a green and rust dumpster. Well, green, rust, and red. Blood red. Streaks and splatters of blood ran a spiderweb pattern on the front of the dumpster. Police tape marked off an area where dark blood mixed with loose paper trash and bits of rotting food. This was the spot the boy's arm had been torn off. But where was the arm? Brian moved past Jimmy, who was still shooting photos like mad. Something was odd about the puddle of blood. A regular, curving line ran halfway through the puddle in the shape of a long, very narrow V. One of the lines of the V ran right up to a wheel on the dumpster. The width of the wheel matched the width of the line in the blood. After the boy's arm was ripped off,
or sawed, or cut, or more likely eaten, Brian, you know damn well it was eaten.
Someone had obviously moved the dumpster away from the wall, into the pool of blood, then moved it back again. Moved it right up against the wall. There was some room between it and the wall, just a bit. Brian noticed a broken chunk of brick not far from the dumpster's back corner. On the ground, crumpled bits of broken pale red brick and pale red powder. That same pale red on the back corner of the green and rust dumpster. The dumpster had hit the wall hard. Hard enough to not only shatter brick, but hard enough to actually rebound a bit. Brian put his head up against the wall so he could look behind the dumpster. The space was narrow and cast in shadow, and he couldn't make it out. But there was something back there, written in blood.
Hey, Sammy! I think there's something here. Have you checked behind the dumpster?
Sammy looked up from his stooped walk. He blinked a few times, as if he had to shift his thoughts from a micro-examination of every last grain of sand to a macro view of the alley and the people in it.
Oh, hey, Brian. No, we haven't checked that yet, but I cleared the area around and I was already inside it. I tried to move it earlier, but it's too heavy. Yeah, but it's clear, right?
Sammy nodded.
Right, go crazy. Jimmy, can you grab Brian some help?
Jimmy Chang lowered his camera. Sure, he said. Eyes still lingering on the corpse, hunting for that one last angle he might have missed.
Yeah, I'll grab you some guys.
Sammy turned his attention back to the ground and commenced his stoop shuffle walk. Brian grabbed the end of the dumpster and pulled, but it didn't move. Fucker was heavy as hell. He braced himself and tried again. The dumpster slowly rolled, pivoting out on the blood-covered wheel, a shrill screeching noise accompanying the movement. He moved it out 4 feet from the wall, enough to look behind.
Jesus, Brian, you've been hitting the weights or what?
Brian turned to look at Jimmy, who had three burly uniformed cops with him.
What are you talking about, man? Sammy and I tried to move that earlier.
Jimmy looked at him with a strange mix of awe and disbelief.
We had three people. We couldn't move it. Not even an inch, man.
Brian shrugged.
Well, I guess I ate my Wheaties today. Now get over here and give me some pictures of this.
Behind the dumpster, written in dripping blood, were two foot-high symbols. The first was a circle about 5 inches across, with a smaller circle, almost a dot, right in the center. Lacing through the circle was an incomplete triangle, the bottom right corner not closed. Leading down from the bottom of the triangle was a half curve to the left, slashed by two horizontal lines. The second drawing featured another circle, with two half circles attached to either side, reaching out like small arms. A zigzag, almost lightning bolt image went through the middle of this circle. It also ended in a half curve to the left, with two horizontal lines. Brian blinked rapidly, then shook his head hard, twice. That first symbol. It wasn't quite the same, but it was the symbol, the anti-boogeyman symbol. He'd drawn the shit on a pad of paper in his apartment several times, and now here it was again, drawn in blood on a brick wall at a murder scene. Jimmy looked at the symbols for a second, looked at Brian, then looked back to the symbols and started flashing away. He turned his camera to the base of the wall.
Oh, snap. What do you think of this sick fucker's crayons, man?
Brian looked at Jimmy.
What are you talking about?
Jimmy pointed, and Brian looked down. At the base of the wall were four dirty, white fingers, each separated at the base knuckle, as if someone had ripped them off the hand one by one. The bloody stub of each finger looked filthy and torn. The positioning of the fingers made their purpose obvious. The killer had used the bloody fingers like markers to draw the symbols on the wall behind the dumpster. Sammy Berzin and Jimmy Chang lifted the green body bag off the cart and set it on one of the stainless steel tables at the San Francisco morgue. Robin Hudson sighed and looked at her watch. She was 6 hours into an 8-hour shift and had hoped she'd be corpse-free for the rest of the day. Sadly, it was not to be.
Aw, thanks, guys. So nice of you to bring this one in so close to the end of my shift.
Oh, you'll love this one, Jimmy said. Brought you the crime scene photos, too. He handed her a portable flash drive. Robin dropped the drive into her pocket as they unzipped the body bag.
Holy shit! What happened to this guy?
Somebody cut off his arm. Then they spiked him to a wall.
Cut off his arm? I don't think so.
She looked closer at the ravaged shoulder.
They tore it off. What do you mean, spiked him to a wall? Is that some new street slang I don't get?
Yeah, it's new gang speak. It means using spikes to pin a body to a wall. Hard to keep up with slang these days, you know.
You're shitting me. They nailed this guy to a wall?
Using railroad spikes, apparently. You'll see from the pictures.
Yeah, real nice.
Every time she thought the job couldn't surprise her anymore, that the city couldn't surprise her anymore, something proved her wrong. Sammy finished sliding the body out of the bag. The bag went into a medical waste container under the table. It would also have to be examined, in case any evidence fell off the body during transit.
Guys, his arm, where is it?
Sammy shrugged.
We don't know. It wasn't on the scene.
Jimmy checked his watch.
Well, that about does it for me. I'm heading home. I got dupes of the photo, Rob, so call me if you got any questions.
Robin threw him a half wave, but her attention remained focused on the corpse. She did a slow walk around the table. Big body, probably 220 pounds, if the arm had been attached, that is. But from the face, clearly just a boy. This boy's arm was still out there, probably in a dumpster. At least, she hoped it was in a dumpster. Because if the perp still had it, that probably meant he was keeping it as a trophy. And trophy collectors meant serial killers. She ended up at the shoulder again. Tacky blood smeared the boy's crimson nylon jacket. She knelt closer, looked at the socket. The arm was gone, obviously. The whole humerus and everything below it, gone. The scapula remained intact, but as her eyes trailed the bloody bone, scraps of tacky human meat plastered to the white, she saw long, parallel gouges. Not straight parallels, not straight lines, but three matching lines that curved and zigzagged.
Whoa! Hey, Sammy, did you see this?
She pointed to the bone. Sammy peered close.
No, I did not see that. Knife marks?
Robin shook her head.
No, man. I think those are teeth marks.
Sammy stood up straight, as if the body he'd carried halfway across the city now repulsed him.
That's nuts. I seen teeth marks on skin before, but on bone? Are you sure?
No, I'm not sure at all, but that's what they look like. Knives don't make parallel marks like that. Look how they zigzag. It's like someone was, well, you know, shaking him. Like how a dog shakes a chew toy.
Sammy held up his hands and backed away from the table.
You're a hell of a conversationalist, Robin, but I'm out of here. This one is all yours.
Oh, Pooh, you're no fun.
Sammy looked hurt.
What? I'm tons of fun. In fact, how about I show you just how much fun I am? How about dinner tomorrow?
Robin looked away from the body, cheeks pulling her lips back into a smile.
Sasha Berzon, are you asking me out on a date?
He nodded.
Yeah, come on. We'll walk down Fillmore. Take your dog. Sit outside. Get some coffee.
Wow, Sammy. You're good. Invite the dog, too. You got some good game.
Sammy gave a half bow.
You have to know the battlefield, my dear. Besides, I see those pictures of your dog every time I come down here. He's cute as hell.
She.
Sorry. She's cute as hell. So how about it?
Robin looked at Sammy. He was a handsome man, the rugged type. And as a criminalist, he knew the horrors that she dealt with on a daily basis. They had that in common. And more importantly, he had catered to her near-obsessive love of her dog. Obviously, Sammy was a perceptive guy. She looked back to the corpse. Sammy would undoubtedly be a great date, but she just wasn't up for it.
Thanks, Sammy, but I'll pass for now. I really don't think I'm good dating company.
Oh, come on, Robin. Not to pry, but you haven't dated for 6 months.
She looked at him again, a touch of anger on her face.
6 months? You know how long it's been since I've dated?
Sammy smiled.
Of course, 6 month rule. It's man law. I couldn't ask you out for 6 months out of respect for Brian.
The 6 month rule? You guys have rules?
Sammy nodded.
Sure, kind of like expiration date in reverse.
So I was sour milk and now I'm fit to serve?
You got it. Look, Robin, if he hasn't patched it up after 6 months, he's not going to. I'm a guy. I know how we think, okay? How about you take a rain check, and when you're ready, you give me a ring-a-ding.
Robin shook her head. She wondered how many people knew she had broken it off with Brian 6 months earlier. Probably everybody in the department. Big city, big police force, but still a relatively small group of people that dealt with the steady influx of dead bodies.
Fine. A rain check, then.
Works for me. Have fun with the fugitive there. Later, Gator.
Sammy walked out, leaving her with the one-armed man. One-armed boy, that was. She gloved up and loaded up a tray with cotton swabs. If those were bite marks, gnaw marks, and she was sure that's exactly what they were, there might be saliva that would identify the gnawer's DNA. Maybe not on the bone itself, but possibly on the jacket, the clothes, somewhere. Somewhere on this corpse was the DNA fingerprint of the killer, and Robin Hudson was going to find him. This kind of savagery was beyond even the normal gunshot, knife, and blunt force trauma deaths she dealt with all the time. A different career had once been open to her, wide open, and still was, but she felt a calling to do something for a society that seemed to be spinning down the drain. She was part of the solution. Her job was intel, really. Intel in the war against crime. She provided the data that helped the guys on the front line. Guys like Brian Clouser. Go out and stop the animals that could do things like this to another human being. Brian. Why did Sammy have to bring him up? It would have been nice to get through a single day without thinking of Brian Clouser. Hello again, junkies. I hope you enjoyed episode number 3. 30-minute episode. What I'm shooting for now is to try and keep the episodes about 30, 35 minutes or so, and maybe do more than one a week. Stop laughing, asshole. Stop laughing. So let me give you some quick news. First of all, 2 episodes of Nocturnal episode number 2 posted last week. I initially posted the episode without the promos that I had told people I would run, immediately changed that, added the promos, re-uploaded the file, and deleted the original file. Unfortunately, iTunes seems to cache things immediately, so even though the file has been deleted for a week, people are still getting that file, because it goes up into Apple servers, and it stays there. So, Apple says they don't cache the stuff anymore, which obviously isn't accurate, because how could people be getting the file when I deleted the source file? Which means that I still really don't know how many people are listening to the sucker. Because once the file is cached, there's no telling how many times it gets downloaded that don't reflect on my stats. So kind of a bummer. The poll last week was asking, what did you guys think of partial sound effects? Overall reaction was that people seemed to like them. I got several cautions to make sure I don't overdo them, don't lay them on too thick. Have to agree with all that. So we're going to keep using the partial sound effects where it makes sense and where it doesn't drag down too much of my time. I played with him again in episode 3, if you heard the scene
where Brian is investigating the alley, looking at the dumpster. Got traffic noise, got some cop noise in the back. I kind of thought it set the scene pretty well. We continue to have problems with ScottSigler.com. This was initially supposed to be one catch-all site for everybody to come and check out the stories, find out more information, contribute, play with the wiki, etc. Robbie Trenchney and I are working on that site. Still having a lot of issues. It's been down more than it's been up. It's up right now as the time I record this. So please, everybody, go back there and check it out. Get back on the forums. Get back on the wiki. Start making comments. We're doing the best we can. And I want to thank everybody, all you junkies, for going in there and helping us break stuff. Because that site has to be bulletproof when April rolls around and we get ready to really push the hardcover of Infected. Last but not least, let me thank my sponsor, GoDaddy.com. If you got a register domain, transfer URL, you want to go to GoDaddy.com. They've got great prices, and when you check out, you type in the code SCOTT1, S-C-O-T-T, and the number 1, and you get 10% off that order. There will be another episode this week, and there will be a call-in episode this week. So if you haven't got your call-in about Nocturnal, dial 206-666-4673. That's 206-666-GORE. As for this week's poll question, I've gotten a couple of dings from junkies who say it's a bit arrogant for me to put best-selling author on the intro of Nocturnal, especially when I'm saying it myself. One person even said it carried a hint of douchebaggery to it. So that's what we're going to put up for a poll this week. At ScottSigler.com, right below the episode for Nocturnal number 3, you'll see a poll which basically is asking, does Scott sound like a douchebag for announcing himself that he's a best-selling author? Give me your feedback on that, everybody. The reason that's there, obviously, is for marketing. Now, all the junkies, I already know you guys know me, it may sound a little douchebaggery, but when new people come in who've never heard me before, and this is a new medium, a lot of them might not understand what a podcast is. They probably barely understand what an audiobook is, but in the larger media campaign that I'm putting together, I'm going to get new people to the site who are going to try it out, and that's a validator. That's a way, just like they put New York Times bestseller on any book cover of anybody who's ever got a New York Times bestseller. They continue to use that on and on and on. Because when people see it, it validates the quality of the work enough for them to give it a chance to see if they like it. So that's the real reason it's there. Of course, I am a total douchebag. I admit this fully. But it's not meant to be douchebaggery and rub it in anybody's face or talk about how big my schwanz is, because it's kind of tiny. It's sad, really. So go to ScottSigler.com, check out that poll, is Scott being a douchebag, and give me your feedback. Catch you guys for the next episode.
You have been listening to Nocturnal, written and performed by Scott Sigler. For more information, go to scottsigler.com. All music in this podcast provided by Uncrowned off their album Devils and Angels, available now at the iTunes Music Store.